You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
On the afternoon of November 8th, 2005, a geological engineering student named Kenton Carnegie went for a walk in the woods of Saskatchewan. It was supposed to be a 90-minute excursion. Later, as the sun set, he hadn't returned. A search party was formed, and what they found in the woods was horrifying. A beast, or beasts, had torn the young man to pieces. But what animal was responsible? The answer has been surprisingly controversial, with two camps emerging. One side believed it was a bear, and the other that it was wolves. One thing seems clear. If you go into the woods with wolves, believing that they won't harm you, there's a chance you'll find yourself dead wrong.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith. Normally I have Ben Radford or Karen Stoles Noah or both with me, but for this episode, circumstances require me to conduct today's episode solo. This episode is a follow-up to our previous episode on wolf attacks and the specter of the big bad wolf. As I researched the case of the 1700 French attacks by the creature known as La Bête, it became clear to me that wolves do kill people and eat them. But if that's true, then why don't we see those kinds of behaviors in North America? I think that question's answered pretty well in our interview today, but it's worth noting that since 2005, we've had at least two probable cases of wolf predation on humans. The case we'll be talking about in this interview is that of Kenton Carnegie, but in 2010, in Alaska, Candace Berner was such a victim as well. And in Russia, India, Afghanistan, and many other places in the world, wherever wolves and humans intersect, there's a risk of such attacks. I don't want to be lurid. The subject matter of this episode is gruesome and frightening. The warning here is not that wolves are fearsome man-killers, but to remember that we humans are made of meat. And when it comes down to it, as far as the wolves are concerned, we're no different from elk or deer or, for that matter, sheep. We're not magically protected by our status as intelligent creatures. Rather, we're damned by our soft bellies and lack of natural defenses. To understand what causes wolves to attack people, we need to understand their behavior. And the study of animal behavior is the job of an ethologist. Today on Monster Talk, we'll be talking with ethologist and professor emeritus of environmental science from the University of Calgary, Canada, Professor Valerius Geist, who has extensively studied the case of Kenton Carnegie and what makes wolves eat people.
Monster Talk.
So you're Valerius Geist, and you're an ethologist and professor emeritus of environmental science at the University of Calgary?
Yes.
Okay. And I came across your name while researching wolf behavior and wolf violence. And, specifically about the case of Kenton Carnegie, who was killed in an animal attack in 2000.
That's right. Yes, I was very much involved in that because his family asked me to investigate this, and I was one of three scientists who totally independently investigated the case and came to the conclusion that it was wolves that killed him, and of course prepared ourselves for to go to court on that. And it was Mark McNay from Alaska who was chosen by the court to be the speaker. I don't want to tell you the circumstances, but he did an absolutely first-rate job.
Okay.
And Mark McNay also left a very large report, which was not published. And my report was not published either, incidentally, but mine has been circulating at least in the Internet.
That's true. We'll link to that in the show notes. Now, before we talk about the case, how did you come to study the aggressiveness of wolves?
Very simply, I'm a zoologist. I retired, and we have an acreage on Vancouver Island. We moved to this acreage in 1955, and this was a wildlife paradise. We had trumpeter swans in the meadows, Canada geese, pheasants, and about 120 deer also scattered through the meadow systems back of our house. And so for the next 4 years, and being a zoologist, of course, and a hunter, I censused these, and we had about 30 some deer per square mile at that time point. I saw a wolf track, and I was very excited by that because I had seen and observed wolves when I was doing my studies of stone sheep and mountain goats in Northern British Columbia in 1961 to 65. And I had wolves visiting my area quite commonly, about once every 2 weeks. And there was a group of seven that repeatedly came, and they were very visible because they were out in the open above timberline. It was an ideal situation, much better than anything my good friend David Meach, for instance, had. And so my views of wolves were then formed by observing these very shy, very beautiful, very large animals, etc. Now, I did work, of course, with large mammals, but only with the hoofed large mammals, with the prey of wolves, basically, and wrote in 1998 a book about deer, in which I basically offered the opinion that various species differed by their anti-predator strategies, but though I had not really studied the predators myself to an extent, but I have studied the prey in detail. And then in 1999, on the 8th of January, in fact, my son was here, and we went out after a snowfall, and lo and behold, we discovered a pair of wolf tracks further back into an area where there were quite a few deer. And I said to my son, by golly, maybe we're going to have a pack this summer. Well, that's what we did. And within 3 months, we had no more deer. They were gone completely. There were snowfalls in November, and I was out there censusing, and there was not a track available. So the wolves then settled themselves around our neighbor's place because he had sheep. They were very attractive to these animals. He had five dogs, and the wolf pack and the dogs developed a deer-enemy complex because they met roughly at 5:30 at a old railway grade. One pack on one side, the dogs on the other, and they howled and barked at each other. And this was a ritual you could set your clock by for a while. So these wolves then ran basically out of food and began targeting people. And I reported on that at a meeting of the Wildlife Society and described in some detail the seven steps by which you can recognize that wolves are targeting people. It turns out that 6 years earlier, two scientists in California had described exactly the seven same steps for coyotes when they were targeting children in urban parks. So this is how I got into it. And I was, because we suddenly were confronted with wolves, and wolves were behaving here in a manner that nobody had ever written about in North America, but they're behaving very much like Russian wolves. And so one thing led to the next, and I began to study wolves from the perspective of when do wolves become dangerous to people, and it's an incredible story in many regards, but that's how it began.
So the Carnegie case in particular was very tragic, but it was also...
Oh,
really,
my God, was it ever tragic. Horribly tragic.
Yeah, it was really frustrating to read about the struggle between people who wanted it to not be a wolf killing and those who said
That's correct.
Was. Right. So how did that play out?
Well, the way it played out was the following. The people that wanted to make sure that it was not a wolf, it was basically Paul Paquette. Paul Paquette is a scientist whom I have known since he was a graduate student. And I knew him as a professor, as a graduate student. He was a fairly good man, but he has become not a scientist nowadays, but an advocate. And you see, from the perspective of the wolf people in those days, It was unthinkable that wolves would tackle humans because there was no history of that in North America. And later on, I'll tell you why there wasn't a history. There's a very good explanation for that. But let's stay with Paul Paquette. So as it started out shortly after Kenton was killed, two people that are of singular importance came to inspect the location. One was a lady. She was the coroner. She was also the information officer for the tribe, basically. And this lady had been raised in northern Saskatchewan till she was 14 years of age in the bush. And she was raised by her father as a hunter and a trapper and a fisher. In other words, she was very, very, very familiar how to make a living in the bush as a child, as a teenager. In other words, she had a very, very good education in tracking. The second person was the constable. He was also a native from northern British Columbia, Saskatchewan, and he was also raised as a hunter and trapper. And these people were on the spot, and the RCMP officer, the native RCMP officer, still saw the wolves there. He fired the shotgun to scare them away, and they inspected the area in detail. And between these two people, they wrote a very good report about what has happened. Now, when this report went to the coroner of Saskatchewan, the man probably didn't realize the significance of the people that had investigated this tragedy. And he wanted to have it hardened up by doing it via the scientific route. And so he got two scientists involved from the University of Saskatchewan. The other one was Paul Paquette. Well, Paul Paquette came, and all that Paul Paquette had to work with is what the rest of us had to work with after the fact. And that was the pictures taken by the constable of the tragedy and the scene. And I can tell you the pictures of of the body is something the most horrible you can imagine. They are not available, God thanks. The family has withdrawn them, and they're keeping them under lock and key, basically. And I don't have them either. I returned my copies to them. But when Paul looked at the pictures, he saw there was a lake, and there were very large holes in the snow. And he said, this couldn't possibly be wolves. It must be a bear. Well, what he made a mistake of was so elementary that it, particularly in the coroner's hearing when it came out, was so embarrassing, is that if you live in the North Country and you travel across a lake, you know very well that the lake ice buckles and that there are going to be lenses of water standing on the ice covered by snow. And you are going to break through those things, guaranteed. And so if you walk across it, it's going to be your footsteps in the snow very nicely, and all of a sudden, boom, you break through into the water below, which is usually about 6 inches or something like that. Normally, these overflows are quite shallow, yeah? And you're going to have a huge footprint as a consequence. And that's elementary tracking. Everybody who has worked to any extent in the North Country, like I have, knows right away that if anything runs across the lake, you're going to have these big things as well as the tracks. What counts was, of course, the tracks on land as they came out of the from the ice. And so we then took the pictures, and I know that Mark McNay took his to four colleagues in Alaska, and they examined everything. They could find only wolf tracks and a fox track, incidentally, and I sent mine to some colleagues in Finland. Not that I cannot interpret, I can. And I interpreted what I saw in front of me as being wolf tracks. And they also came up, which is very cute, with a fox track. There's no bear tracks there anywhere. There are human tracks, wolf tracks, yes, but no bear tracks. And besides, there was fresh snow on the ground. So that was a group of scientists that examined in post hoc. But after the coroner, and the officers had examined them, the Saskatchewan government sent up two game wardens. Now, they came a day late, and they also examined the scene, and they also could find nothing else except the wolf tracks. And remember, if a bear had gone into the area, no matter how much trampling had occurred in the spot where Kenton Carnegie was killed, all you had to do was go a little bit further to see where if the bears, if they were entering, were coming, and you would see the track. And bear track is utterly unmistakable. None of that was happening. So we had two native people that examined the track. We had two very competent hunters, incidentally, also examining this area, only found wolf tracks. We had two game wardens examining this. They also found nothing else. And we had, looking at the pictures, four scientists from Alaska and two scientists from Finland, and myself and Mike McNay and another gentleman from Ontario, another scientist from Ontario. All we saw was wolf tracks. Now, the only way a bear could have been there is if he had wings, he was flying, and his feet never touched the telltale snow.
Which is very unusual for bears, right?
It would have been a touch unusual for bears.
Yeah.
There we go.
Yeah.
That's right.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18-plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, I'm Paul Giamatti.
And I'm Stephen Asma.
Each week on Chinwag, we dig into the weird topics you wonder about, that you care about, the stuff none of us are totally sure of, like the Bermuda Triangle, Mothman, consciousness, philosophy, UFOs, ghosts, or, say, Bigfoot.
So who's to say that there's not alien species that are Sasquatch?
Like, I've seen a ghost, and I would hear something walking and breathing.
Maybe every path is right. I will accept as a premise that every path is right.
That is a face on Mars. Eyes, nose. It kind of looked like Wilson the volleyball.
Some people enjoy the waves or whatever crashing, and I enjoy listening to a quantum physics audiobook.
I do think there are many things in the world that we just don't understand and probably won't understand.
That's our whole show.
So join us every Wednesday on all major podcast platforms and find us on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter at ChinwagPod and Wagon.
I have written a lengthy article about that, just to clarify it, and there's been another article, a good one, that came out on it as well. They're available, and I can send them to you if and when you need them. But what was more interesting to me was to then investigate why, what were the circumstances that led to this huge tragedy, and why did it happen, and why, for that matter, did we have wolves behaving one way globally, and quite another one in North America. And it was crystal clear that here on the island, I had the situation where the wolves were behaving globally. I called them, they behaved like Russian wolves. And the conditions of these were that they run out of food, basically, that they are in close proximity to habitations, that they then take down dogs and cats, then they turn on to livestock, and eventually they target human beings. We're the very last in line, mind you, but we are still on the menu. The very last one, mind you. So what's the difference between here, Russia, oh my God, in France, there's a book out where the historian describes over 3,000 deaths. It was 3,000 people killed in France. And in Italy, something similar, in Germany, anyway. Why the difference? Well, the difference is very simple. From 1920 onwards into the 30s, 40s, 50s, ending in the 60s. We had a situation where in the heartland of wolf distribution in North America, which is Canada, northern Canada, there were thousands upon thousands upon thousands of impoverished men, trappers, which were trying to make a grub stake catching fur and making less than $500 a winter, incidentally. And desperately poor men, particularly in the 1920s and 30s. And that was virtually the only thing to have. There was no social assistance or anything of this nature. If you wanted to eat, you better have money. The only way you got money was you went trapping. And so we had, in Alberta alone, 5,000 trappers, licensed trappers. Yeah, British Columbia, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, and so on and so on and so forth. You can see there are tens of thousands of trappers. Now, these trappers had no loves for wolves. Guaranteed, because for two reasons. Whenever wolves show up, game disappears, and the men have nothing to hunt and kill for themselves and their dog teams. And that was very bitter when that happened. There was nothing to sneeze about. I have followed the writings of some of these trappers. They escaped starvation, sometimes by a hair. It was so important for them to have wildlife available to kill and to shoot for themselves. So when wolves showed up, gone was the wildlife. The second reason is that wolves followed their trap lines, which were very long, and the wolves could travel a long ways, and the wolves would destroy the fur that they had caught. So he had absolutely no love for wolves. And with every means, legal or illegal, they were trying to capture these wolves on the trap line. Now, they were on top of that encouraged by a bounty. And the bounty was set in such a fashion that it was more worthwhile bringing in a wolf for bounty than selling the fur. And this was recognized. The worthlessness of the fur, in other words, was recognized. So all they had to bring in Alberta was just simply the scalp of the wolf, and they were getting their full payment then. So first of all, the trappers, encouraged by a bounty and the misbehavior of wolves, were trying to kill every wolf possible. Then there were native people, which were also participating, but which we know very, very little. On top of that, we had predator control officers, which were operating in the livestock zones, and they were killing every wolf in sight. Then it was taken as good behavior and good form for wardens, I know that in British Columbia, to go out after the season poisoning wolves. On top of that, you had an open season on wolves for anybody to kill them anytime, anyplace, wherever you want to. Now, from the bounty records, we know that the trappers brought in for bounties roughly in Alberta about 1,000 wolves a year at peak periods. And it turns out that it was roughly one wolf killed for every five trappers. It means it's not that easy to do so. Well, in addition to that, a rabies breakout in the early 1950s in the north led to fairly massive wolf poisoning from the air by horse meat being thrown out of aircraft and onto lakes and along river systems and so on and so forth. And that was terminated in 1961. And that's when I went to the wilderness, incidentally, 1961. And we had wild duck coming out of our ears at that point because of the severe reduction in wolf populations which had taken place. But the most important thing is that everybody who knew wolves in Canada, myself included, knew them only when they were at low concentration, absent in most areas, very, very shy, and these wolves were, of course, no problem. They didn't kill livestock because if they did, they were dead in a very short time, killed by livestock, by predator control officers. And the wolf is, in fact, some of the most remarkable observations were made in that period, because we had height of rabbit concentrations, which happened every 10 years. And the wolves were taking advantage of those. And when they were on a rabbit feed, they ignored everything. And so my good friend, the late Reinhold Eben Ebenau, describes how wolves are hunting rabbits right in amongst wintering moose, and the wolves don't give a damn about the moose, and the moose don't give a damn about the wolves. Remarkable observations of that kind, yeah? So when the wolves are at very, very low number, when they're being controlled by one of the most murderous machines that has ever existed in controlling wolves, of course there are no attacks on humans. There are no attacks on wild, on livestock to speak of. Wolves are very shy, indeed. It's only when they run out of feed, when they are in close proximity of humans, that they become a totally different animal. And so everybody who has studied wolves ignored what I have just told you. They were not aware of that. And they thought the kind of wolves that they met was the natural behavior of wolves. It wasn't. It was the most unnatural behavior because it was an artifact of extreme control.
What are the signs that wolves will hunt humans?
The signs are that they begin to observe humans. They sit down and watch and watch and watch and watch humans. Yeah. And eventually they come closer and closer to humans. My wife and I have experienced a wolf coming to within about 10 paces of us, standing there, watching us. Wolves are observation learners. We know that from studies carried out by colleagues that studied wolves, you see. They're observation learners, and they learn. I don't want to go into detail, but the point is, this is how you know that the wolves are targeting you, because they keep on watching and watching and following you and watching you. And then comes the preliminary attacks, which were beautifully described for the Kenton Carnegie case, because 4 days before he was killed, two wolves attacked two men from the camp, one a pilot, the other one a physicist. And the two young men grabbed hold of little trees growing in the bog and smashed them towards the wolves and kept the wolves away and thought it was a lark, basically, and returned to camp, but they took beautiful pictures of the wolves. And this was a exploratory attack, and that's totally predictable.
So it sounds like in India, from my research, as well as in Russia.
Yes, India and Russia and Japan and Korea and Turkey, Finland, Germany, France, Italy, all of those places. There's reference. If you were, if you had the time, I could send you the articles I've written about that, and my originals have all the references in it. And yet, you can look at that.
Yet there seems to be this sort of myth that wolves don't harm people.
That's a myth. That, and by the way, this myth has killed not just Kent and Carnegie. It killed three people that I know of.
Well, that is very helpful. I really appreciate your time on this.
Okay, I have to run, actually.
Yeah, I know. So thank you so much for talking to me. I really appreciate it. And we'll put links to your material on the website. Thank you.
Monster Talk.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Monster Talk. Today you heard an interview with Professor Valerius Geis discussing the causes of wolf attacks on humans. Monster Talk is produced with the support of Skeptic Magazine and listeners like you. You can donate to Monster Talk on our website by going to monstertalk.org or skeptic.com. Let me tell you about a new project which needs your help. I want to get transcripts of our show. On average, it's going to cost me about $70 an episode to do this, but there's two major benefits of this project. First, it will allow Google searches to find the episodes and increase the likelihood of a monster-curious netizen to find our show. Second, it will allow Wikipedia authors to easily link to our show for reference purposes. I think some really important facts have been revealed here on Monster Talk that aren't widely known on the internet. Your donation to our transcript project will help get those facts out to the general public. If you can't afford a donation, don't feel guilty. You can still support the show for free by recommending it to your friends or by giving us a positive review on iTunes. You might also enjoy the Monster Talk fan page on Facebook. There you can meet other Monster Talk fans and get a lot of really fun monster news and commentary from the many talented and knowledgeable listeners who are probably a lot like you. Just search for Monster Talk on Facebook or follow the link at monstertalk.org. Music during the introduction was by Symbian Project and used by permission. A link to the tracks will be in the show notes. And Monster Talk theme music is by Pete Stealing Monkeys. Thanks again for listening.
For more skepticism? Want to learn the truth about the scientific controversies of our time? Then subscribe to Skeptic, the quarterly magazine Stephen Jay Gould called the best journal in the field. To subscribe, visit skeptic.com today.
I am the bad wolf. I create myself. I take the words. I scatter them. In time and space.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.